I'm Aaron Henkin, and this is Midday. The University of Missouri, Yale, Claremont McKenna College, Amherst, just a few of the schools that have seen recent student protests over racial intolerance and unequal treatment. Student protesters are demanding college leaders' resignations, and they're asking university administrations to issue formal blanket apologies for past discriminations. How reasonable are these demands? What are they likely to accomplish? And how about the methodologies? Hunger strikes? Bans on the press? This hour on the program, perspective and analysis from the editor of Inside Higher Ed, from a Loyola University student newspaper reporter, from a member of the Black Student Union at Johns Hopkins University, and from the director of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Higher Education. Join us on Midday, right after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Sheila Cast. Good to have you along with us. Midday is a public forum. It's a radio town square here, a place for dialogue, a place for interaction. And so I want to first and foremost welcome you, our listeners, into the conversation during the hour ahead. Join us with your thoughts, your questions, your comments. The number to call, 410-662-8780. Or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. College students, university students, we're especially interested in hearing from you this hour as we get ready to embark on a conversation about you, your life on campus, and the racial and intellectual climates at your institutions. The number again, 410-662-8780, or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. The University of Missouri, Yale University, University of South Carolina, Occidental College, University of Kansas, Claremont McKenna College, the list goes on. College students across the country are leading protests and demonstrations to call attention to racial intolerance and to demand a response from school administrators to their concerns, the concerns of minority students. Later on this hour, we're going to be hearing from a member of the Black Student Union at Johns Hopkins University. We'll also talk with a staff member at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, who works with student groups on diversity and cultural issues. We're also going to hear from Robert Shibley, director of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. He has some criticisms about the protests and their implications for free speech on college campuses. But first up, I want to welcome Scott Jasek to the program. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. He's the editor and one of the founders of the online publication Inside Higher Ed. That's a publication that covers all things related to higher education, everything from student loans to technology to this current string of protests. Scott, welcome to Midday.
Great to be here.
So, Scott, let me start just by asking you to give us an overview of this wave of campus protests across the country. Where are they happening? Why are they happening?
Well, they're happening all over the place, and that's actually part of what is striking here. It's certainly not new that there are racial tensions on many campuses and that many minority students are unhappy with the way they're treated. But what we're seeing here is a wave. It started in Missouri and spread. We're seeing a lot of sort of direct civil disobedience-style protests with people sitting in, walking out of classes, things like that. And it's a range of issues. Sometimes it's prompted by a specific incident where somebody did something racist or offensive. Other times it's about sort of the everyday encounters that minority students have with others, students and faculty members who seem to belittle them or stereotype them. And sometimes it seems to have to do with a disconnect between being recruited with a lot of promises of a welcoming, tolerant environment and maybe not finding that.
Scott, what are the goals of the protests? Are the goals clear? Are they symbolic?
The goals vary, and it's important to note that on different campuses there are different goals. Many have called for prompter and more rigorous efforts to root out insensitivity, whether that is punishing people involved in racist incidents, whether it's promoting a better education about diversity so that people won't say the wrong thing. Other demands include more minority faculty members, more support for cultural centers that serve minority students, and a sense of more critical mass. A lot of students speaking out about how difficult it is to be the only Black or Latino student in a class, wanting just more people so that they're not presumed to be speaking on behalf of their entire race or ethnic group.
These protests, these demonstrations have resulted in the stepping down of high-level university administrators, presidents. They've also inspired a backlash. I mean, what are some of the points of criticism that people are leveling at the protesters, their demands and their methodologies?
Well, some of the backlash comes from civil liberties groups, and you'll be hearing from a representative of one of them later on this show. But the concern is whether people are conflating comments that offend or anger with things that should be punished. It's a fine line between saying, I don't want offensive ideas, and banning them or punishing them, particularly if you're at a public university where you are covered by the First Amendment. So a lot of things that may be offensive may not be illegal. There's also concern in some about whether some of the demands may exceed what some colleges and universities want to do. Students have gotten some big wins with, you know, the resignations of the chancellor and president at the University of Missouri, a dean at Claremont McKenna, but many other colleges are providing some but not all of what students want.
Scott Jasek of Inside Higher Ed, I want to talk to you about the phenomenon of protesters' safe zones, and specifically their desire in some instances to ban reporters and photographers. What's at the root of the problem the protesters have with the press?
Well, here, one thing I think is important is we're not talking about all the protesters, but
right.
Definitely at some campuses, they have been dismissive and tried to keep the press out, saying they wanted privacy. Part of the problem is where this really came to a head was at the University of Missouri, which is at a public university, and it came to a head with an open-air, sort of on-the-quad kind of area that was very much in, you know, public space at a public university. And some of the protesters said, no, we're going to shoo away the press. There was quite a backlash against that, and they changed their attitude. I don't think anyone in the press is saying that they have a right to go into students' private dormitory rooms or every space at a public university, but where we've seen the conflict is when some protesters are protesting in very public ways, which is part of the tradition of protest in America. You can't really control access in the same way that you do if you're, you know, just submitting a petition or a letter. And so there's definitely been backlash about that. But I should note at the University of Missouri, the protesters changed their tune amid the criticism.
Scott, I wonder if you might speak to, some of the underlying reasons why protesters would want to keep the press at arm's length, specifically minority protesters.
Well, I mean, it's important that in the same way that I said that the protesters are very different, let's face it, so are journalists very different. And I think many of the protesters see the press as hostile, perhaps based on the reactions of some but not all journalists. They don't see the press necessarily taking them seriously. The University of Missouri, and at many campuses, there have been concerns about these issues for some time, and there's distrust, I think, of journalists who only when the football players got involved at Missouri started to take it seriously. So I think a lot of the protesters don't view the press as caring what's going on all the time. Now this has become a hot issue. And so people are paying attention. And it's also important to remember these are college students, and while they're adults and they're inviting press attention, many of them don't have a lot of experience in dealing with the press.
I wonder if we might talk a little bit more, Scott, about the collision of protests, these protesters' demands, and free expression that's happening on campuses right now. I look at one instance you point out in this recent article in Inside Higher Ed at Amherst. There are students demanding that the administration condemn certain posters on campus that say things like all lives matter and the victim of the Missouri protests is free speech. This is a really interesting sort of point of friction here, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's important to note, one, Amherst didn't, in fact, take the action that the protesters wanted. And there's a difference between, I think to many people, between criticizing posters, which is itself another form of free speech, and demanding that people who put up certain posters be punished. And so there's, there is a free expression, consistent way to object to posters put up. And some posters that were put up were designed to make a point in a strong way that certainly would antagonize. When people object to All Lives Matter posters, it's not because anyone really doesn't agree that all lives do matter. It's because All Lives Matter has become a phrase that has been used counter to the Black Lives Matter movement. At the same time, while many people might find that phrase, All Lives Matter, putting it up in posters around, to be antagonistic or even trying to provoke, many would say that is itself a form of free speech.
It really comes down to, I think, as you point out in this article, the difference between a safe space and a comfortable space, and really trying to negotiate the boundaries of those two things.
Right. Well, I quoted the president of Kenyon as saying that safe space, which is a phrase that's been used quite a lot, the way he was arguing it is that you shouldn't be criticized for who you are. So a black student or a woman or whomever shouldn't be attacked for being a black student or a woman. And in that sense, most college leaders do want their campuses to be safe, a safe space. But some have been saying everyone should be comfortable everywhere. And what that president said, and many say, is that in fact colleges and universities are places where where you want ideas debated, where you want people to disagree and argue it out. And it's very difficult, I would say, to be open to all that argument, all that discussion, and to keep everyone comfortable, because some of that discussion may well be people saying things that make you uncomfortable. One thing that saddens me about the discussion is there maybe hasn't been enough discussion about how to promote civility. People have talked about it as if the way you keep everyone comfortable or safe is to not have challenging statements. In fact, perhaps there's a lost art in American society, particularly in media, where you see all this shouting at one another, of making strong points that criticize various positions, but in a civil way.
That really is the crux of this article, a great article by Scott Jasek in Inside Higher Ed. That's an online publication that covers higher education news and policy. Scott Jasek is the editor and co-founder of Inside Higher Ed. We appreciate you being on the program, Scott. And now we are going to move on and welcome Julia Joseph. She is a sophomore and student journalist for the Greyhound at Loyola University in North Baltimore. She's covered student activism by the black students at Loyola, which, by the way, a slim 5% of the total student body there. And Julia Joseph joins us by phone as well. Julia, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. So talk to us, Julia, about your campus, about Loyola. Has Loyola seen protests concerning issues of race?
Yes, actually. So last semester in December, we had a demonstration that was a general demonstration about Black Lives Matter, and there was a march around campus. It was organized by several student activists that were involved with the Black Student Association, with Alana Services, and several students of color. And then last week, we also had a demonstration on campus that was a solidarity movement with the students at the University of Missouri. The student organizers created a poster that said, "We hear you in the middle," and students were welcome to go up and write whatever they have heard that is potentially offensive on campus, that makes them feel unsafe, experiences they've had. It was a very moving march, I feel, especially as an observer, as a reporter. It was a very exciting time to be there.
Julia, I wonder, when the students at Loyola gather on these occasions, Are they trying to accomplish something specifically on the Loyola campus, or are they, as you say, primarily interested in showing solidarity with other movements?
Well, I think it's both. I think that a lot of these students come from backgrounds where they need to voice that Black Lives Matter in their own home communities, but also in the Loyola community. I've experienced several things where students of color have come to me and explained situations they've been around campus where they didn't feel safe or they didn't feel welcome on campus as well. I feel like a lot of the demonstrations we have on campus are more generated towards solidarity, but they do hold water on Loyola's campus.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned before that Loyola is a majority white school, like 95% white students. I wonder what the racial climate is there in terms of, you know, what we're hearing and seeing and reading about on other campuses. Is there an active conversation about microaggressions? Is there a sense of awareness, a growing awareness about racial intolerance, racial injustice on your campus?
I think there's a growing recognition that we need to have these conversations. And we've had several of these conversations through lectures and fishbowl settings, especially after the uprisings in April. There were several conversations then, and there were also counseling sessions for students who felt very disturbed by the events to go and voice their feelings. I believe that there is also a movement to increase diversity on Loyola's campus. The class of 2019 that just came in is actually the most diverse class that we've had in our entire existence. So Loyola is actively moving to create a better environment for our students of color, but they also do see some aversions to it by white students. I've heard things such as the students at Missouri are fighting for dominance and not equality, which can be a big aversion when you're trying to create a more comfortable and safe campus for students of color who deserve education just as much as I do at this private institution.
Yeah, I wonder if you might say more about backlash. You might have heard our conversation with Scott Jasek, the reporter with Inside Higher Ed, talking about pushback on college campuses to these demonstrations, the methodologies, the stated goals. Is there a sense among certain students at your university that that their individual rights, that their free speech, that their climate of free expression is being impinged?
I don't think any of our students believe that their free speech is being limited, but I do believe that students feel they're not being heard on campus, and that was one of the biggest pushes with the poster that says "We hear you." So it was in response to people who have said things to them or experiences they've had on campus that were not welcoming experiences, but also "We hear you." We validate everything that you've experienced on campus, and the administration has actually been more supportive of these demonstrations that I've seen at other universities that I've heard at other universities. But also more than I expected. Students, after the demonstration last week, got emails from our class president, from our acting president, Dr. Donovan, supporting the student organizers, student activists, and desiring that conversation to be further held with the majority of students on campus as well.
Interesting to consider, to take this moment as they say, a teachable moment for you as a university student and as a student journalist. This is probably an interesting, unexpected educational opportunity for you as someone covering this.
Yes, it definitely is, especially as a person that comes from a background where I don't have to say my life matters to know that my life matters. But covering this as a student journalist, I found that I need to step out of the picture more and talk to the people whose stories are not being told and to understand why they are performing these demonstrations, why they need to have these demonstrations, and what kind of history they come from to validate their presence on our campuses.
Julia Joseph is a sophomore and student journalist for the Greyhound at Loyola University. She's covered student activism by black students at Loyola. And Julia Joseph, we appreciate your input here on the program. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, a member of the Black Student Union at Johns Hopkins University tells us about her experience on campus and the group's calls for change. We're also going to talk with the Assistant Director of Student Life at UMBC and later on from a lawyer who is wary about how policing speech and expression on college campuses might infringe on the rights of students and staff and faculty. If you want to join the conversation, you are most welcome. Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Sheila Cast. President Obama weighed in over the weekend on the wave of student protests at college campuses across the country, protests demanding accountability for racial intolerance and injustice. The president applauded the student activists, but he said they ought to spend time listening to those with whom they disagree and to reject tactics such as trying to block speakers they disagree with. That, President Obama said, is a recipe for dogmatism. Listeners, what are your thoughts? Join us at 410-662-8780 as we continue the conversation now with Lisa Gray. She is Assistant Director of Student Life for Cultural and Spiritual Diversity at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Lisa, welcome to you.
Thank you, Aaron.
And also we're joined by Tiana Warren. She's a junior at Johns Hopkins University. She's also the public relations chair. That's part of the executive board of the school's Black Student Union. And Tiana, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
So, Lisa, let me start with you. You work with student organizations at UMBC. What are you hearing from them about these events, current events, protests across the country?
Well, like in other college and university campus communities, we're hearing a lot. I would say that a lot of our students are all over the map, so to speak, in terms of their opinions on the topic. And that's not untypical, I would imagine, of any other community. If we're talking about specifically our black student community, we are very diverse at UMBC. So we have students who self-identify as African-American, Caribbean-American, as well as of various African national backgrounds. And so the opinions are divergent, even within the black community at UMBC. But I think by and large, most of our students think the student activism, this latest wave, is healthy. I think they are very supportive. We have always been that way at UMBC, and that's a strong value of ours, diversity and inclusion. And I think our students get it by and large.
That's Lisa Gray from University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And Tiana Warren of Johns Hopkins University. Talk about your reaction to these events and about the Black Student Union's perspective on maybe Hopkins' atmosphere.
Sure. So the Hopkins atmosphere thus far seems to be that the black students feel very much like a minority in our opinions. Part of going to an elite institution is that there's this environment of, I guess, privilege. And so with that privilege comes the general view or the general notion that everything is fine and dandy and this is the way things should be going. And any type of dissent or uproar is very inconvenient. It's very disruptive. So in terms of the Black Student Union standing up and letting people know that we are not comfortable, we are not happy with how things are going thus far, and we're not happy with our undergraduate experience, is very conflicting for a lot of students. It's surprising for a lot of students, and it's difficult for a lot of students to grasp.
Tiana, I'll ask you this, and then Lisa, I'll have you kind of sound off on this as well. Microaggressions and triggering. Let's talk about these terms. For people who aren't familiar with the concepts. I mean, how would you explain these concepts and their impact on students' lives?
So I don't understand the term microaggressions. It seems more like a term used to say offensive things in a way that trivializes them. In terms of trigger warnings, there's been a lot of debate and a lot of dissent on should professors, you know, put a trigger warning on their syllabus? Should there be warning signs for certain topics that might make students uncomfortable? But from my experiences, I've never seen someone desire a trigger warning that was trivial. Most of the time, there are students who are speaking up from sexual assault, from, you know, racial incidents, and they're desiring trigger warnings for specific topics such as these. But it seems like there's a trend in the media to sensationalize or trivialize trigger warnings to the point where they become spoiled, bratty college kids who just want to be comfortable. And I honestly have never seen anything like that.
That's Tiana Warren from Johns Hopkins University. We turn now to Lisa Gray at University of Maryland, Baltimore County, UMBC.
Sure. In terms of microaggressions, that term comes out of a body of terms connected to social justice education theory. And it's a fairly new term that a lot of us are just now starting to get familiar with. But I kind of break it down like this. Microaggressions are kind of like if you were to imagine someone being cut in a paper cut manner all over their body, 1,000 different paper cuts. In and of themselves, they don't do anything, right? They may just annoy us, but the totality of them can cause someone to hemorrhage and or die. So that's pretty much what microaggressions do. They are these words and behaviors that can degrade and demean us to the point that our livelihood can be in jeopardy, our sense of self-esteem, self-efficacy, and certainly when we're talking about students, that has a huge impact in and outside the classroom. Microaggressions can cause students to kind of wonder about whether or not they are good enough to be at a college, despite being perhaps smarter than their classmates or more deserving of scholarships than some of their classmates, to low dropout rates and lower numbers lower rates of matriculation. It can be very serious. So again, it's a term that we're just getting familiar with. Now, in terms of triggering, microaggressions are related to triggering. Triggers really are associated with some mental health theory that's out there and some other social justice education theories. But really, it's defined, according to Dr. Kathy O'Bear and many other theorists, as an instantaneous response to stimuli without accompanying conscious thought. So basically, when you're triggered, it causes some kind of emotional response that you don't really have control over a lot of times. So it could be anger, it could be fear, embarrassment, pain, or sadness. And when we're talking about racial triggering in the cases of what many of our Black students are saying on campuses now, it has some very real impacts, mental health-wise, emotionally, as well as physically.
Death by 1,000 paper cuts. That's a really interesting way. That's a really, that really sort of puts the term microaggressions into a perspective I hadn't really realized before. So thank you for that explanation. Tiana, what do you think of that? A notion of 1,000 paper cuts. Is that phenomenon the kind of conversations that you have had with other folks at Johns Hopkins University and the Black Student Union?
Yes, it's very similar to anonymous posts or little comments on articles that try and degrade Black people, but in a way that's very clever. And that, you know, these aren't, you know, your ignorant, you know, flag waving people. These are people who are very educated, and so they sound very intelligent when they're arguing that, you know, Black people don't deserve to be here because of affirmative action. They're arguing that, you know, Black lives don't matter because of these reasons. And it's the little things that do add up, firstly, because they are anonymous, and secondly, because there is a very weak response to these comments. So when someone goes on Yik Yak, which is a very popular college application on your phone where you can post, you know, jokes or funny comments or, you know, anything anonymously whatsoever without the repercussions because there's no name on your comments. Those things really do add up. We are actually starting to take collection and send those collections to the university administration to let them know that it's not isolated. It's not just one guy said something last week. It's been years and years of these types of comments, and they really do add up and affect your performance in college as well.
Tiyan Warren is a junior at Johns Hopkins University. She is a member of the school's Black Student Union. Also in studio with us, Lisa Gray. She is Assistant Director of Student Life for Cultural and Spiritual Diversity at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, UMBC. You're tuned to Midday. Aaron Henkin here for Sheila Cast. As we continue our conversation, I want to welcome a guest now by phone, someone who I think our guests here in studio will have a lively conversation with. He joins us by phone from Philadelphia, Robert Shibley. Robert Shibley is the Executive Director of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. It's an organization committed to defending and sustaining individual rights such as freedom of speech, legal equality, and due process at America's colleges and universities. The foundation, FIRE, the acronym, Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, they made some news earlier this year when President and CEO Greg Lukianoff co-authored a story for The Atlantic, an article titled The Coddling of the American Mind. Robert Shibley, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Robert, you've heard the conversation here in studio about microaggressions, about triggering. These are both things that your colleague addressed directly in the article he wrote for The Atlantic, The Coddling of the American Mind. Let me just let you begin, Robert, by talking about where this leads us, which is presumably to a fundamental philosophical question about higher learning, right? A question about how to argue. In a way, a question about how to respond to ideas that you think are wrong.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of separate concerns, although they're linked. The concern that Greg, my boss, our president, and John Haidt, who is a psychologist at NYU and a best-selling author, were talking about in that Atlantic article, The Coddling of the American Mind, is that this idea of trying to create an environment on campuses where people are totally free from triggers or microaggressions or what have you, these sorts of everyday slights or misunderstandings or, various exercises of free speech that make people uncomfortable, their concern was that this is actually creating a generation of people, teaching them to be less resilient than they should be in a free society. You're never going to have a total agreement in a free society. You're certainly never going to have a situation where everybody is going to be polite and considerate all the time. And so I think their concern was that we're actually teaching people to think in ways that will ultimately be destructive to their success. The other aspect is, and this is where the rubber really meets the road, is we can talk about trigger warnings and microaggressions. The question is, what do we want to do about it? Unfortunately, many of the solutions that you see out there are effectively, they end up being close to police state solutions. They have to do with monitoring or punishing expression. And you also see the politicization of the ideas about trigger warnings and microaggressions. So as a microaggression, for instance, as the University of California put out in their president's office microaggression list, you see things like saying America is a melting pot as a microaggression, or I believe the most qualified person should get the job as a microaggression. And these are undoubtedly political statements, but here they're being cast as aggressions. And that makes them, you know, what do you do when you are faced with aggression? Well, obviously you use force to stop it. And so that's our worry when it comes to trying to set forth a culture that would be totally free of trigger warnings or microaggressions, or even, you know, partially free. Is where do you draw the line? Who makes the decisions as to what counts? And how do you do that without basically becoming repressive yourself?
That's the voice of Robert Shibley. He's executive director of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Robert, I'm going to let our studio guests respond to you, and I'll begin here by turning to Lisa Gray of UMBC.
Well, actually, this may sound surprising, but I actually agree with a lot of what Robert just said. I think most of us who do diversity and social justice education work on college and university campuses would agree with a lot of what he said. We are staunch free speech supporters and would not be supportive of censorship of any kind or shutting down the free flow of ideas, the exchange of ideas are critical to the higher learning experience. In order for us to have a strong learning community, we have to be able to agree to disagree with one another, to disagree vociferously in some cases, but to do so civilly. And I think that's what we are talking about here with regards to microaggressions and triggering. It's not that we're telling folks you cannot have certain ideas, beliefs, and to communicate those in the public space. What we are saying is that if we are to be a community that values equal access to learning, if we are a community that is supposed to support all students, and if we are a community, as most higher education communities try to be, I believe, that wants people to succeed, then we have to be willing to create a space where everybody is included, where all people are valued, where all people are given a voice and allowed a voice, and when all people are visible. And I think that's where we can all agree, I would hope, that we need to be moving to as a community of learners within higher education.
Lisa Gray, Assistant Director of Student Life for Cultural and Spiritual Diversity at UMBC. Tiana Warren, we're going to get to you in just a moment, but first we need to take a short break. And listeners, we want to hear from you, too. If you were a minority student when you were in college, what was your experience like? If you are in college right now, what's your experience like? Did college have an accepting atmosphere, older folks, when you were in college? Does it now? Share your thoughts, your ideas, your questions for our guests at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Aaron Henkin in for Sheila Cast. As we continue our conversation now about the recent wave of protests on college campuses across the country, I'm joined in studio for the conversation by Lisa Gray. She is Assistant Director of Student Life for Cultural and Spiritual Diversity at UMBC. Also here in studio with us, Tiana Warren, a junior at Johns Hopkins University, and Tiana is the Public Relations Chair. That's part of the Executive Board of the school's Black Student Union. On the phone with us, Robert Shibley of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. And Tiana, I promised you an opportunity to respond to what we've heard from Mr. Shibley, who says, microaggressions have become politicized to the point where perhaps we're overreacting to them, and this might be a symptom of increasingly fragile minds.
It's interesting hearing the adult perspective, because I think that it can be out of touch sometimes. I think what we're really asking here is, was your comment necessary? It's not necessarily about, you know, shutting down an opinion because we disagree with you. It's learning and growing up out of certain comments that aren't necessary. We all, you know, stopped, you know, saying the rape jokes. We all stopped, you know, saying the racist jokes, hopefully. And so when we talk about trigger warnings and we talk about microaggressions, what we're really saying is, you know, there are people here who have had issues and experiences and have faced discrimination and assault and things of that nature that you haven't yet. And so when you come from a place of privilege and you come in and you say things because you can, we're asking you, you know, to stop and think, was your comment necessary and did you really need to say something like that? So I think there's a difference between you know, the president making a speech about how people are uncomfortable and that's why it's kind of a coddling environment. And what's actually going on college campuses, which is, okay, you're old enough to know that your comment has no logical, you know, basis and it's not necessary in this conversation.
Robert Shibley, I'll give you an opportunity to continue the conversation from here. You hear a current college student saying, you know, maybe it's been a little while since you've been in college. Maybe, you know, you're a little bit outside of the frame of reference of someone like Tiana's experience to really understand what's at the heart of this.
Right. Where does that leave people on a college campus, though? You know, this idea that, well, it wasn't really necessary for you to say that. Who decides what's necessary? You know, how are we comfortable with either a majority or the authorities, or, you know, I don't know who would choose, you know, to determine what is necessary and what's not. I think, you know, is as an attempt to sort of set up a social norm of speak before you talk. I think that has been a norm for a long time, and if we've lost that, you know, we should get back to it. Part of that is just this is simply a politeness kind of norm. But presumably the sort of person who is saying things like, I believe the most qualified person should get the job, or some of these other things that are labeled as microaggressions, or let's say an artist who's putting together a work of art that's found triggering, like we saw up at Wellesley with the Sleepwalker statue a year or two ago, which was a very realistic, lifelike statue of a man, sort of a schlubby man in his underwear, sleepwalking across campus. Obviously, the artist was trying to make a point there, and to a certain extent, when you're doing art, when you're engaging in expressive purposes, you're intending to trigger people. You're intending to trigger certain emotions. Somebody had mentioned earlier, anger or fear or, you know, whatever those might be. A lot of expression is actually aimed at doing just that. And so my worry is that, you know, where does that leave the people who aren't along with the campus mainstream? You know, the campus mainstream may say, you know, we don't want to make jokes about X, Y, or Z anymore, but that mainstream is different today than it was, you know, 5 years ago, and it'll be different again 5 more years. How can we set up a system? Let's put it this way. I don't think it's possible to set up a system of policing these things that isn't effectively a political system of just saying this is acceptable and this is not.
Again, the voice of Robert Shibley, Executive Director of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Lisa Gray, Tiana Warren, I'll give you a chance to respond in just a moment. First, I want to bring our listeners into the conversation. Again, the number to call, 410-662-8780. 410-662-8780. And we turn now to the phones and hear from Christian in Baltimore. Christian, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, I have had the distinct honor to teach a couple of classes in creative writing and fiction and also in nonfiction. And part of the experience is making people uncomfortable, and that's true basically across liberal arts as a whole. You, in philosophy, in theology, in writing, in English, in history, you don't want people to feel comfortable. Half of history now is literally making people uncomfortable with the facts that have come up to the surface about what has passed. Now, there's a difference between that and, you know, blatant racism. I am not arguing in favor of something like that. But to remove one of the elements that makes education worthwhile and makes you think and develop and grow and realize how you interact with the world around you would be removing an incredible amount of the value that education brings to an individual or a group as they grow.
Christian in Baltimore, thanks for your call. To my guests here in studio, I'll reiterate Christian saying, some of the most valuable educational moments are the ones where we feel most uncomfortable, the moments that make us angry, the moments that trigger us perhaps in some way. And you know, as a result, we learn in valuable ways. Lisa Gray, I'll let you respond to that.
Christian is absolutely right in saying that. I was educated at a liberal arts institution for undergrad, and I absolutely agree that there needs to be discomfort as a part of the learning process in and outside the classroom in order for growth and learning to really take hold. That said, however, what we're talking about really is not about the exchange of ideas and how they make us feel uncomfortable. It's about when people's identities, the very nature of who they are, is being attacked or criticized to the point that they feel all of these triggering emotions that I mentioned earlier, anger, fear, and that is what can disrupt the learning process. So if we're prepared to say that we are okay with people and who they are being attacked in and outside the classroom in the name of higher learning, then we have totally fallen off the rails, I believe, in terms of what our mission is as higher educators. And so that is what we're talking about here. It's not about the, not having the ability to kind of critically analyze things that are ideas that are divergent from what you would normally believe or theories that you've never heard of. No, what we're talking about is when people's identities, the very part of who they are, their race, their gender, and other aspects that make them a human being attacked, and what that does when people are allowed to get away with that without consequence, when we don't check that as a community and don't realize that there is a very real impact to that kind of speech and that kind of behavior.
Free speech, hate speech, challenging ideas, personal attacks, and the boundaries between. That's Lisa Gray. Tiana Warren, I turn now to you.
Yeah, I definitely agree with what has been said, and I just have a short comment to add that I think that when we talk about the classroom setting, we're talking about topics that are supposed to be educational, and the conversation is supposed to be productive. So when we're talking about, trigger warnings, and we're talking about, your comment was a microaggression. Usually microaggressions are meant to silence. They're not meant to be educational. They're not meant to foster an actual conversation. We keep bringing up the comment of, I want the best person to get the job. Usually that's not, water cooler conversation. That's when someone brings up the topic of, this African-American man got the job and, was he as qualified as me? Was it affirmative action? And then someone always replies with, well, I want the best qualified person to get the job. So we're not talking about actual exchange of dialogue in that situation. We're talking about someone who's trying to silence or someone who's trying to put down or demean someone because of who they are as a person. So there's a difference that people need to be aware of.
We've got just a few minutes left in the program. I want to return to the phones one more time and welcome Alex in Baltimore to the program. Alex, you're on the air.
Hey, this is Alex. I just had a question for your panelist, Tiana. Previously, she had said something related to coming from a place of privilege. And I'm just wondering, in and of itself, if that is a microaggression and who is in a position to determine if someone or people are from a position of privilege and what goes into determining the factors that decide whether or not somebody's from a place of privilege?
Sure. Alex, interesting question. Alex saying, microaggressions, do they go both ways? Tiana, I'll give you a quick chance to respond to that.
Yeah, so the question of do they go both ways shows that it really doesn't go both ways. We're talking about calling out someone who has the upper hand here. I won't get too much into detail about, systematic racism and oppression and the idea of a hierarchy of who really has the power here in this country. But me pointing out the fact that you have the upper hand and you have a place of privilege above me and that I have to work twice as hard to get half of what you have is not a microaggression because It's not a form of oppression. It's not me trying to silence you at all.
I feel like the conversation is just getting started. Alas, the hour is up, and we're going to have to say farewell. I want to thank our guests, Lisa Gray of UMBC and Tiana Warren of the Black Student Union at Johns Hopkins University. Also, thanks to our guest on the phone, Robert Shibley, Executive Director of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Apologies to listeners who we didn't get to, we appreciate you listening, and we appreciate your input. For Sheila Cast, I'm Aaron Henkin. This is Midday, and we'll see you next time. Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Melody Simmons and Connor Graham. The Midday intern is Adam Droneberg. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.